Today on the 21st, housing was already expensive for many Illinoisans, but for some, the COVID-19 pandemic has made a tough situation into a crisis. Then, you know that saying, this entire meeting could have been an email? Many of us lucky enough to do our jobs from home during the pandemic have learned most of our offices could have been an email, and some of us are not excited about going back. And many addiction aid organizations in Illinois have been forced to cut back hours or close altogether as the coronavirus pandemic continues. Today, we'll talk about the effect that might have on people who rely on their life-saving services. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, and WNIJ in DeKalb. But first, the news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. As we go to air Tuesday morning, officials are reporting more than 96,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Illinois, including 4,234 deaths. The disease has been detected in all but two of Illinois' 102 counties. Meanwhile, nearly 30% of homeowners in Illinois are considered cost-burdened, and that's the subject of our first conversation this morning. That means that they're spending a large portion of their income on mortgage payments, property taxes, utilities, and other costs, and now during the pandemic, homeowners and renters are struggling even more in the state. Our next guests are going to talk about some of the resources that might be available and what issues they're seeing when it comes to housing right now. Bob Palmer is Policy Director at Housing Action Illinois, a statewide coalition that works to make housing more affordable. We're also joined by Danielle Chenoweth, the Cunningham Township Supervisor in Urbana. Danielle, Bob, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks so much.
And if you're having us.
Yeah. If you are worried about housing right now, or maybe your housing situation has changed because of the pandemic, you can always join our conversation. Give us a call at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Or send us a tweet. We're at 21st Show, 21ST Show. Bob, I want to begin with you. What issues is Housing Action seeing right now related to the pandemic?
Well, immediately after the pandemic hit, we were most focused on working with service providers around the state and state and local government to make sure that people who are homeless had someplace safe to be. So a lot of moved people into hotels or larger spaces. We were very glad $1 million in emergency funding to support that. And now, obviously, with all the economic fallout from COVID-19, as you mentioned at the beginning, we're very concerned about renters and homeowners who've lost their job, lost income, can't afford the rent or their mortgage. Right now, there are moratoriums for most people on that. But we're concerned that the economic fallout from COVID-19 is going to be much longer lasting than the immediate public health emergency. And we need resources to protect everyone related to their housing needs.
And Danielle, I'm going to start with the same question to you. What about in Urbana? What are you seeing there, and what sort of help are people seeking?
Yeah, first I would just say the situation before COVID was already pretty dire in our community. So 66% of Urbana renters and 63% of Champaign renters were paying over a third of their income in rent. We had 2,800 calls for rental assistance and 5 evictions filed per day, per business day in Champaign County. So since COVID hit, we've seen a doubling of the people reaching out to us for help. And in particular, a lot of our programs are really set up to help people with a one-time rental assistance that they will not qualify for those programs because they're laid off. So we have launched a new program, a COVID rental assistance program with United Way and other partners, funded largely by local community members to help people who are laid off and are seeking some gap funding while they look for other employment and wait for the economy to improve.
Bob, you mentioned a moratorium a moment ago on evictions in Illinois. Can you talk a little bit more about that, and how long does that last, for example? What is that rule do?
Well, there's a combination of federal and of evictions. The broadest one is Governor Pritzker's executive order that he did towards the end of April that bans eviction filings in court. There was a previous executive order that just restricted law enforcement from carrying out evictions, from actually removing people from their end of the eviction process, but cases were still being filed in court. So the second April executive order banned the filing of eviction cases for renters. There are some protections at the federal level for homeowners. And that executive order is tied to the state's disaster proclamations that Governor Pritzker put forward. And obviously we want to make sure that those moratoriums in place, both at the state and federal level, last until there's adequate financial resources to help people to pay their rent and mortgage so they don't wind up without a place to live.
Is this enough, having this moratorium? Are there people being left behind by this?
Well, certainly people who have no home whatsoever, are not impacted by these moratoriums. The issue there is that, homeless shelters have done a good job, I think, serving people that were in the shelter that the time COVID-19 hit in terms of getting them into hotels or other safe spaces. But there's a lot of people who didn't have any access to the shelters. As Danielle said, housing was a big problem before COVID-19 hit. And there's still a lot of people who don't have access to any shelter. They're doubled up with someone else in a, maybe unstable situation, or victims of domestic violence who are kind of stuck without options to move. So overall, there is this pre-existing shortage of affordable housing that COVID-19 has just brought much more attention to. And we've been telling everyone that, now more than ever, housing is healthcare. And I think more people are starting to believe it because of COVID-19.
And I wonder if, as the weather is getting warmer, you have some shelters, for homeless individuals that tend to close up during the warmer months. Is that a concern here?
It's a significant concern. So we just have winter shelter for single women and single men in the community. Those shelters, thanks to local support, have been able to stay open during the executive order, the governor's order. But as soon as that's lifted, those shelters are planning on closing. And so those homeless individuals, and we've housed almost 400 distinct men and women in the shelters in Champaign County this winter. So those individuals essentially are going to be facing street homelessness situation. And as a result, as Bob said, a lack of housing is a healthcare crisis. So ultimately, as a community, we have to move to year-round shelter, and we have to ensure we have sufficient shelter for families with children. We have only 8 units for the entire county. People wait as long as 150 days to get into so-called emergency shelter. So we have to fix the things that were broken before COVID. And I always tell people, we don't want to go back. We're not looking to go back. We're actually looking to go forward and see if we can fix the problems that we had before COVID struck our community and our world.
So, Danielle, we've been talking about the homeless for the last couple of minutes. And I should say, if you're just joining us, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We've been speaking with Danielle Chenoweth, Cunningham Township Supervisor, and Bob Palmer, who's Policy Director with Housing Action Illinois. We're talking about the housing crisis that is going along with the COVID-19 crisis and pandemic. And Danielle, let's talk a little bit more about renters. What help is available for people who are renters in Illinois right now?
So I can speak to Champaign County. So essentially, we have, thanks to a very tight partnership with the Regional Plan Commission, City of Champaign Township, Cunningham Township, United Way Community Foundation, we have a couple of different options. So the first is for folks who have income, but they hit some bump in the road, like they had a medical emergency, a family emergency, loss of income. We essentially have a rental assistance program that pays up to $600 in one-time assistance every 2 years. So that program has been going as a coordinated effort for several years. And we, you know, will serve hundreds of families each year in the community. We added to that recently due to COVID, the COVID rental assistance program. And that's for folks who are laid off. So they do not have current income. They were laid off due to COVID, but they don't qualify for unemployment. That could be undocumented workers. It could be cash economy and precarious workers, folks who have run out of their unemployment. And so we have a COVID rental assistance for those families that will pay 1 month's rent. Both of those programs can actually be accessed through this hotline. The hotline is 877-548-4205. And that hotline lets people connect to rental assistance. Ultimately, though, the issue is for many people, they're going to need more of a tenant-based rent assistance, a longer-term solution for them, or housing vouchers. So I also serve on that Housing Authority Board. We serve about 1,500 people with housing choice vouchers. We have about 1,000 to 1,500 in rental properties. We only serve basically 1 in 5 that actually needs housing support in our community. So we really need to look at other ways in which we can free up support or bring in additional dollars to support housing subsidies.
And Bob, we've been talking about renters now. Bob, what about homeowners? Is there assistance? What are we hearing from homeowners? Is there assistance available to people who own their own homes?
Well, at the federal level, if you have a federally backed mortgage, which if you don't know if you do, you should refer to your loan documents or reach out to your lender. Lenders are required to offer you a forbearance plan. And also there was just over the weekend an extension of the moratorium on filing foreclosure cases for those people with federally backed mortgages. If your mortgage isn't federally backed, you're not covered by those protections, but obviously you should still appeal to your lender to work with you. And many banks, not all, have made public commitments to work with people to do everything they can to avoid foreclosure, but certainly there are banks that have not.
Hey, what does that mean, a federally backed loan? Is that like if you're in the VA or
like if you have a FHA or Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac insured loan? It can be tough to tell, and there's actually and maybe you can post it on your website, information databases where you can look up and find out information about your loan if you're uncertain.
Okay. You know, another issue that this pandemic brings up when people are living together is that in some apartment buildings, you may have people who are COVID-19 positive, and other tenants may want to be aware of that. I wonder, are people required to report that to landlords, or are landlords required to notify people if they get those kind of reports, Bob?
We have got inquiries about that, and the short answer is no. There's no obligation to report and from landlords or tenants. Obviously, we're under the stay-at-home order, and if people have concern that people are engaging in behavior that violates that order, then they should contact probably their local public health department as a first to inquire for more information about exactly what's required or not required.
And Danielle, we only have a couple of minutes left here in our conversation, but I wonder, when this is over, are you worried about a slower recovery and what sort of long-term effects we could be looking at?
Oh, absolutely. So Champaign-Urbana is really a company town, and our economy is so tied to the University of Illinois. And in times of economic slowdown, that's actually good for us because a lot of times people go back to school. University towns have a certain stability. But if the university were to go to a primarily online format, which they haven't decided to do at this point, but if they were, the housing market here, the food service market, we would see some real drastic changes to our economy and a real slowdown. Even if they don't, what we're going to see is probably several years of ripple effects. I serve on the public health board, and you know, we're anticipating this is not a one and done situation with pandemic. Is essentially there are waves of concern. So I think long term, what community leaders need to do is stop thinking about this as something that's going to be over in a few months. We need to come together as a community, and we need to have a summit around housing and long-term solutions. We also need to talk short-term. When this eviction freeze is lifted, we are going to see some very, very significant housing insecurity issues. So I have talked to the leaders, both mayors and the head of the county, about at the minimum canceling all late fees for renters. It's a very easy thing that we can do that will help renters get out from under. We also need to consider rent freezes. I know landlords that have attempted to increase rents starting in July, and that's not going to work for the community. It's not that people won't pay rent, it's that they can't. And landlords really need to come together with their tenants and be flexible and negotiate things with them. And then long term, we really have to look at permanent supportive housing for the 400 or so people who are street homeless, change the definition to homelessness so that women and children are seen as homeless. And we really need to increase the housing subsidies and support, as well as affordable housing in the community.
Okay, and I'm afraid that's going to have to be the last word there. Danielle Chenoweth is Cunningham Township Supervisor. We've also been speaking with Bob Palmer of Housing Action Illinois about the housing situation amid COVID-19 in Illinois. Thanks for being here. Stay with us. More to come on the 21st in a moment. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. You may have heard that phrase, "This whole meeting could have been an email," referring to that frustration we feel when an in-person work meeting could have just been a simple, much shorter message. Those of us who are lucky enough to still be working during the pandemic and are able to work from home safely are now realizing that a lot of things we did around the office for our jobs could have been done remotely, and that perhaps the entire office itself could have just been an email. Heidi Bauman is professor of management and leadership at Bradley University. Her research focuses on work-family interface and employee performance management and development. She says whether we enjoy working from home right now or may depend a lot on our working personality. And she joins us to explain more. Professor Bauman, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Also joining us is Professor Pettis Kent. He teaches at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University Chicago and worked on developing and managing supply chains for Procter & Gamble Company for over a decade. He researches knowledge management and operations and policies, among other topics. Professor Kent, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Brian.
And we want to know about you. Are you working from home for the first time and dreading a return to the office? Or maybe you've developed a newfound appreciation for your commute and other routines of work. You can join our conversation at 800-222-9455. That number again is 800-222-9455. You can also, of course, always tweet us at 21st Show. Professor Bauman, I want to begin with you. Whether or not we have enjoyed working from home in recent months may come down to a category that we fall into. And for the purposes of our discussion today, I understand there are two broad categories. Can you describe those two groups for us?
Yeah, so people have talked a lot about how introverted or extroverted you are mattering for whether you're enjoying this work from home time. But in the work-life literature, we talk about a category, or maybe even more so, a continuum of how much you like to integrate your work in your personal life versus how much you like to segment your work in your personal life. And so people who are strong integrators and really prefer that, maybe in really enjoying this time, they are very comfortable blending work and personal life. They're happy to switch back and forth. People who are stronger segmenters prefer to have some physical and also just some mental boundaries set up. And so they might, on a busy work day, prefer to spend the time needed in the office, and then once they come home, truly be at home and away from work.
So integrators, I guess, is the stereotypical, like, checks the smartphone first thing in the morning and maybe at night and responding to emails at all hours, whereas the integrator shuts it off and waits until the next morning.
That's right. So integrators are going to be switching back and forth throughout the day, both mentally and possibly physically. And then segmenters prefer those distinct and separate times. Although even people who are high integrators right now are experiencing just an extreme amount of blurring between these lines. So everybody probably needs a little bit of boundary management, regardless of their preferences on this continuum.
Yes, my kids could burst into the room at any time, as I've said.
Same here.
So, can I ask you, Professor Bellman, are you a segmenter or an integrator?
So I actually prefer to integrate to a pretty high degree, although, like I said, this has been an extreme amount of integration. And so there's still a need to find some times from being interrupted by children and other childcare responsibilities that are just making this time extra challenging right now.
And Professor Kent, this may be, I don't know, a personal place to start, but I wonder, are you a segmenter or an integrator as you listen to this conversation?
You know, I think I'm an integrator too, but like Heidi said, I do feel like this has really challenged this idea around how much I want to integrate, because I do like to have kind of my time at work and my time in the office with students interfacing, and then also my time at home with my son. So yeah, I think I'm more integrator, but this has definitely been an interesting time.
Yeah, I guess integrating is one thing when you have a choice about it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, okay. So Professor Kent, I wonder, do you think that companies are waking up to this idea that some jobs, you know, can be done from home that maybe in the past they had never considered having remote employees do that sort of thing?
I think so. I mean, when I was at Procter & Gamble, there were many times, especially in the mid-aughts, where either new mothers or new fathers may choose to work one day at home or what have you. And it was almost, they were looked down upon, and because it was like, okay, we all have family, why aren't you working 5 days a week? But now I think this has opened the firm's mind to the idea that we can be productive from home. And especially if you look at certain fields, like the field that Heidi and I are in, and being service providers from an education standpoint, at least at the college level, we have the technology to be able to still be effective, even if we like to interface with our students and other coworkers. We have technology like Zoom and like other things that we have implemented over the years that have allowed us to be more productive. And so I do think going forward, firms will say, okay, does this job really need to involve people in the office, or can they be productive remotely?
And Professor Bellman, what about you? Have you seen that stigma around telecommuting until now? Is that possibly changing in the pandemic?
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. And so there have been noted that one of the biggest reasons people are hesitate to telecommute, even when there's a set policy at their organization, is because there could be some career backlash for them in terms of promotion and advancement. And so one of the big positives out of COVID-19, and there's not a lot of them, is that this is becoming the norm. So research shows when telecommuting is more of a norm in an organization, it's accepted and more common, then that career backlash is eliminated and people see a lot more of the benefits.
As a reminder, you can join our conversation at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. I'm Brian Mackey. This is the 21st, and we're talking about how working from home has changed our relationship with the office. And we wonder if you are eager to get back to the office, or maybe you want to continue working from home more. Let us know. We are speaking with Heidi Bauman, a professor of management and leadership at Bradley University, and Pettis Kent, a professor at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University. Professor Bauman, there's also this concept of spillover, and I think you were sort of alluding to this when you were talking about integrating, but there's this idea of, you know, working from home, our family and life and work life kind of spill into each other. Can you talk about some of the advantages and disadvantages to this idea of spillover?
Yeah, absolutely. So we see both negative spillover. So that's when you would have some stress and strain in one area, such as your personal life, that comes into your work. You're perhaps psychologically preoccupied with that stress while you're trying to work. Or even behaviorally, I think this is a challenge right now where there's different behavioral expectations for interacting with family members, perhaps being very compassionate. And then at this time, we're expected to go on to a Zoom meeting immediately and have that kind of command and control of the virtual room. So those things can be kind of negative spillover. At the same time, a lot of my research is focused on the positive spillover. So we're having new opportunities now to perhaps have lunch with our family. Our kids might say something funny, put us in a good mood, and then we can carry over that positive energy into the meetings throughout the rest of the day. So what you're looking to do here is use some boundary management techniques to try to eliminate a little bit of the negative stress and spillover that occurs, and also capitalize on some of this work home enrichment or positive spillover.
Well, you mentioned boundary management techniques. What is that? And do you have any other strategies to try and manage that spillover?
Yeah, there's a couple great suggestions. So even if you're a strong integrator, and certainly if you're a segmenter, can there be opportunities for physical or even psychological separation? So can you find a little space that is your workspace right now that is really defined as where you do your work? Or can you even separate the technology tools you might use? So video conference on Zoom with work, and then maybe use a different tool for family, different email accounts, so that you're able to not see that impending work deadline when you're trying to enjoy some time with personal contacts. So those are little things. Also, can you come up with even a small transition period? I think most of us are pretty excited about not having to commute to work. At the same time, there's some really good transition time that occurs during a commute. So even a walk around the block or kind of wrapping up your day with documenting your to-dos for tomorrow might allow you to park that and transition to your other role.
Yeah, I never knew there was advantages to the commute, but even my yeah. relatively short commute here in Central Illinois, I definitely feel the absence of it right now. Professor Pettis Kent from Loyola University, you study knowledge management. That's one of your areas of academic interest. I wonder if you find that there are some advantages for companies to maybe integrate more work from home days into their standard processes.
Right. So, you know, if we think about knowledge management, it's this idea around how do firms effectively create, transfer, and retain knowledge between people, between different locations within the organization. And so knowledge is typically stored in, they say, members, tools, and tasks. So people, technology, and routines. And so now I think both service organizations and manufacturing organizations have had to rethink of how they store their knowledge. If they don't have easy access to each other in terms of the people in the organization, they may have to codify this knowledge in a more regimented way, perhaps through standard operating procedures or technology that is storing this knowledge so that it can be easily accessible from remote locations. I think this is easier said than done when you're dealing with certain types of service jobs like the legal field, say accounting, that type of thing. I think it's a little harder to do if it's a more intimate service organization like food service or healthcare field. And so I do think through this pandemic, firms are having to rethink, how do we, you know, keep our efficiency? How do we still maintain high performance if we don't have access to each other face to face? And so I think in that respect, it's a good thing, because the more adaptable we are as organizations, I think the better we'll be able to adapt in the future.
And what about the flip side of that? I mean, do we lose something by not having that FaceTime in the office?
For sure, because what we've seen in knowledge management research is that we can't completely codify our knowledge base. We have what's called explicit knowledge, which is codifying the knowledge, have it written down. And then we have tacit knowledge. That tacit knowledge is also called tribal knowledge, where you see someone in the hallway and you exchange ideas, or it evokes some great step forward on something that you talked about in a meeting. Some of that goes away when we're on Zoom calls or Zoom conference calls, because in those calls you typically just stick to the script and you handle the agenda and then you log off. So we will have to find a way to still be creative, still bring about some of that tacit knowledge, even remotely. So yeah, there's definitely a shift that's going to have to occur if we're going to remain competitive, remain effective, et cetera.
Yeah. And only a few minutes left in our conversation. Professor Bauman, I saw this funny tweet not long ago that, and I'm sorry, I can't remember where I saw it, but it basically said something like that revelation you feel like you're having about that you could have been doing your job from home most of this time. Like, companies have known that for a long time. They just didn't want to let people do that. And I wonder if you think that managers after this pandemic will be more willing to allow people to work from home in the future.
I see that both in the short term and in the long term. In the short term, of course, we see that even as companies are going to have employees returning to work, there's going to be things like capacity limits that they have to deal with, and also contact tracing. As that continues to advance, people may recognize that even though they're feeling healthy, that they've had contact with someone who's tested positive for COVID-19. And so I hope that organizations continue to see, and I think that they will, working from home as a great tool for being able to meet the needs of individuals and the employer. We're going to see a lot of decision-making happen, and we always have in telecommuting, at frontline supervisors and managers. So to the degree that organizations can equip them with ideas about the standards that are to be used, and then that frontline manager is going to have to work with the individual employee going forward. And that's where we see a lot of benefits come to both sides, employees and employers. But again, I think that we've just reduced a lot of stigma by testing this out and seeing that productivity can increase. And we know that links with job satisfaction tend to be positive, as well as job performance. I also think we might see a limited use of it. So it's not an all or nothing proposition. We know that some of these outcomes are actually maximized with partial telecommuting, say 2 days a week. And I think that might be a great option for a lot of companies.
Interesting. Well, only about a minute left in our conversation, but Professor Kent, I understand you're presenting a webinar soon at Loyola about responsible reopening. I wonder, what do you think are the ethical obligations of companies as they look at reopening, especially since in some states the urge to return to some sense of normalcy has outpaced the advice of public health experts?
Sure. I think there's definitely going to be a responsibility for both manufacturing and service firms to think about both their employees as well as their customers. Now, in manufacturing, typically they're in a manufacturing operation, they're not as exposed to their customers. And so they have to focus on creating new standard operating procedures to keep their employees healthy. But in a service organization like again, food service or hospitality. I teach a service operations class, and I always talk about how service operations is so hard to deliver because it's hard to separate the employee and the service that you're giving the customer because they're intertwined. And so how do these firms come up with new procedures to protect both the employee and the customer is going to be the challenge. And it's definitely an ethical consideration that they have to consider, not to just think about the financial benefit.
I'm afraid we have to leave it there. That was Pettis Kent from the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University. And we also spoke with Heidi Bowman, Professor of Management and Leadership at Bradley. Thank you both for joining us. More to come after a short break. This is The 21st. Stay with us. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. About half of addiction aid organizations nationwide reported having to decrease services on account of COVID-19. That's according to a new survey from New York University. If cutbacks and closures continue, it could mean the spread of diseases like HIV and hepatitis if clients are not able to exchange their syringes. These organizations also typically provide medical and life-saving services like Narcan. I want to welcome Scott Fletcher to the show. He's executive director of the Community Action Place in Murfreesboro. Among other services, the organization provides free HIV and STI testing, overdose prevention training, and needle exchanges for Southern Illinois. Scott, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Brian. It's good to be with you.
And we're also joined by Casey Toner from Chicago, where he's been reporting on this topic for the Better Government Association. Casey, good to have you back on the 21st.
Thanks for having me on, Brian.
Scott, I want to start with you. What role does the Community Action Place serve for your communities? What sort of services do you offer?
So, Brian, we actually provide syringe exchange, syringe services for the southern 19 counties of Illinois. We have about 400 participants in our program, and we provide not only clean syringes, cottons, cookers, sharps containers so that we can get the dirty syringes properly disposed of, but we also provide HIV testing, hepatitis C testing, and syphilis testing for participants in our program.
And how many people use those services? I understand that the Community Action Place is one of, or if not the only, full-time needle exchange south of Champaign.
We are. We have about 400 participants in our program. We deliver about 90 participants every week.
Okay. And what have the past few months under the stay-at-home order been like for you and your organization? I gather you're still open, but you've had to adjust your operations somewhat?
So we've had to adjust our operations in that we have had to revisit our policies, especially as they relate to protecting our staff, making sure that we are social distancing, as well as having personal protective equipment when we deliver services. That's really been a challenge because our participants want to see the face of the people that are visiting them to deliver syringes. They want to know, you know, they've gotten used to it now. In the beginning, we just social distanced, kept 6 feet apart, made sure that, you know, we were maintaining that distance with the participants, and then we kind of eased into the PPE so that people were given a little bit of advance notice of what we were going to be doing. We didn't want to take anybody by surprise. We've had to adjust a little bit with respect to the way we are, the amount of clean syringes that we are providing. Not knowing exactly what was coming next, we started the stay-at-home order time period with providing double the number of syringes that we had been providing in the past. letting people know, you know, we don't know where this is going. We're trying to make sure that you've got clean syringes. You know, we want to make sure that they stay safe and protected, and that we can possibly reduce the spread of HIV, hepatitis C, and syphilis among the population.
I think it's interesting. Most people, I think, might think of a needle exchange as a place where people have to go to get a service. But you do house calls. Is that because of the rural nature of the area you serve? Or
we do. We actually are. Our model is we do have a drop-in center in Marion, Illinois. They can also, we have some fixed sites where they can come and pick up syringes as well. But one of the things that we have noted, especially in Southern Illinois, is that the rurality has a huge impact on people's ability to get to, you know, let's say they live out in the country in Elkville, Illinois. It's hard for them to get to Carbondale. We don't have a great transportation system that works for all of our communities. So we took the approach of very early on of making sure that we were meeting them where they needed us to meet them. So we usually, most of our new participants, we will meet at a public location, a Walmart parking lot or something of that nature. And then they ease into us showing up at their house. And we actually do outreach to some of the drug using houses, trap houses. We actually will deliver to those as well. And those have, you know, that actually gives us a lot of buy-in from people in the community with respect to the people who use injection drug community. They appreciate the fact that we reach out, that we meet them where they're at, and we don't judge them for any of their behaviors.
If you're just tuning in, we've been speaking with Scott Fletcher. He's executive director of the Community Action Place in Murfreesboro. We also have Casey Toner with us from Chicago. He's a reporter at the Better Government Association. Casey, in your recent reporting, you looked at different addiction aid organizations in Chicago. I wonder if what Scott is saying echoes what you've been seeing in the city.
Chicago is a little bit different. The models are a little bit different, and the density is very different. You know, the Chicago scene serves about 10,000 heroin users, needle injection users specifically, in the Chicagoland area a year. And combined, they distribute a little more than 4 million needles a year. And there's two organizations. One of them does mobile delivery and drop-off primarily. Another organization, which is affiliated with the University of Illinois Chicago, has storefront operations, you know, throughout, you know, the west sides and the south side, and they have a north side location as well. And, you know, what we reported in our story is that they have, you know, to varying extents, reduced some of their services, and, you know, the people that they typically serve, you know, just aren't there. And I spent the most time with COIP, which operates the storefronts. And, you know, they've shut down a couple of their storefront sites. And I went to one of them, and I kind of watched what they were doing. And I spoke to people that came there about what their lives were like. But, you know, the storefront organization said that they had, you know, the number of needles that they exchanged had fallen from 24,000 in March of 2019 to 5,000 in March of 2020. So they've seen a huge drop off in the first month, you know, that the lockdown order really went into effect.
So you mentioned COIP. I gather that's the Community Outreach Intervention Project. And as you say, Casey, the amount of needles exchanged has plummeted compared with this time in previous years. What does that mean for people who use these services typically?
Well, you know, we spoke to several users who, you know, were kind of giving us the, you know, their impressions when we told them. And they basically said that it's not everyone, certainly, but there, you know, is a population of high-risk users that will share. And, you know, you share needles that can, you know, low needles, you share them, that can spread hepatitis C and HIV. And, you know, we also spoke to a young man who said that he was running low on his needles because one of the storefronts closed down. And so a buddy of his told him some, you know, method where he could try to sharpen one of his old ones with a nail file. And he said that, you know, it felt terrible when, you know, he tried to use it. You know, so these shutdowns and, you know, the scaling back of services do have, you know, an impact on people's lives and on public health.
And I guess if people are sharing, then that means potential more spread of HIV or hepatitis, things like that.
Yes. And, you know, we mentioned in our story, there's a very famous case in Indiana that had a prohibition on needle exchanges. And because of that, there was an HIV outbreak that infected more than 100 people. And, you know, the state ban on needle exchanges played into it. And then Governor Mike Pence kind of slow walked, rescinding the prohibition, which, you know, kind of made everything worse. So, you know, time and time again, you know, needle exchanges have shown to, you know, really, you know, prevent outbreaks of deadly disease. And, you know, right now, I think another, you know, great thing that they're doing is that, you know, they can also help identify potential COVID cases because, you know, people who are using heroin have a harder time sheltering in place. And they're often, in Chicago at least, they're often congregating, you know, with other people who also have a hard time sheltering in place. And when people go to these storefronts or they go to the vans, you know, they can, you know, potentially get flagged as, you know, exhibiting some symptoms and then, you know, be sent to a public health provider. And I think this is also really important too, because, you know, in the city, many of these folks rely on public transportation, you know, so it is not just, you know, users spreading this deadly disease amongst themselves, but, you know, to the greater population at whole. And I think that's a really big thing to think about when you're thinking about public health in a pandemic and infectious disease, is that it can be spread outside of, you know, these high risk groups.
Casey, I want to play a clip from your reporting. This is University of Illinois Chicago health specialist Stockton Mayer, who's been working with the Community Outreach Intervention Project in Chicago and doing testings of homeless encampments and other sites.
For our clients here at the Needle Exchange, we're really concerned about, you know, what happens to them when they get COVID. One of the biggest issues that we faced, I think, when we first started kind of addressing this with our clients was, you know, if someone comes in positive symptoms, where do they isolate? Because a lot of our folks are experiencing homelessness every day. So, you know, where do they go to isolate if they can't go home? What happens if someone's positive and you've got opioid use disorder? You know, how are they quarantined effectively or isolated effectively? And how is their opioid use disorder treated?
So, Scott, I want to bring you back into the conversation, because aside from the potential health consequences from fewer clean needles, as some addiction aid organizations have had to close or scale back, I mean, that is obviously not the only health issue at play here, as we just heard in the clip. And Casey was mentioning these communities are dealing with the spread of COVID-19. We've only got a few minutes left in our conversation, Scott, but can you talk about how those things are affecting each other in your part of the state?
Sure. So one of the things that we are doing is we are screening our program participants for COVID. When we see them, we are then referring them to the COVID hotline. And we have had participants that have actually been able to get plugged into care. We have, and I noted that Casey brought up, that, you know, that one of the big issues is opioid use disorder. And we do have about 40% of our participants are opioid users. However, we have a large percentage of our user population that is actually using injection methamphetamine. So for us, you know, we are trying to make sure that our opioid users are plugged into not only getting screened for COVID, but we also want to make sure that they are, that we have a mechanism to get them into supportive care for their opioid use disorder while being treated or quarantined.
Okay. And there is so much more I think we could talk about this story, but I'm afraid we have to leave it there. We've been speaking with Scott Fletcher, Executive Director of the Community Action Place in Murfreesboro. And we also have been talking to Casey Toner. He's a reporter with the Better Government Association. And we will tweet out a link to Casey's reporting on this topic. There's a lot, like I said, a lot more we didn't get to in the show today. Scott, Casey, thanks so much for speaking with us on the 21st.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you, Brian.
And that is all the time we have for today. As always, you can keep up with our show on Twitter, as I just mentioned. We are at 21STShow, that's 21st Show. We tweet out links and analysis about what we've been talking about, but also encourage you to sign up for our podcast. You can find us pretty much anywhere you get podcasts, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, NPR One. Just search for The 21st. Our program is produced by Libby Foster and Anna Casey. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Special thank you to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.